excellent work.
Thanks. No problem.
You feel like getting something to eat?
No, thanks. I gotta get back home.
Oh, come on. After all this hard work, least you can do is let me buy you some dinner.
Really, I have to get back. Maybe some other time.
Sure, sure. You know, Wendy, you've really been doing a great job.
Thanks, Tom.
The sexual harassment training video, one of the joys of the modern workplace. They are easy to dismiss as a waste of time, but should we give these videos more of a chance, especially in the era of Les Moonves and Me Too? We'll talk about that later in the show. First up, though, California Governor Jerry Brown talks climate.
I very proudly stand with the legislators and the activists who have said this is the way to go, and sure enough, we're going there. So let's get the bill out and get it done.
That was Brown yesterday signing a major environmental bill, committing the state to being carbon neutral by the year 2045. The bill came up last year, but didn't make it out of the legislature. So when I spoke with the governor yesterday, I asked him what changed.
Well, it's passed, number one. Number two, I think there's greater awareness of the threat of global warming, so people are prepared to go further. And finally, I've accompanied this bill signing, with an executive order that sets the state on the path to zero carbon emissions, or what we call carbon neutrality. And that's much broader than merely cleaning up the electricity network. This is something that involves agriculture, industry, buildings, cars, trucks, and actual sequestration of CO2. To get to our goal of carbon neutrality, we have to do many, many things. Cleaning up the grid and getting in the first stage to 60% renewable by 2030 is a very important next step. And then beyond that, we go to 100%, and that will definitely be daunting.
Yeah, daunting, but not impossible?
No, not. It's a necessity. We have to not only get to zero emissions by 2045, we have to get to minus emissions by developing the technology of sequestering carbon. And when I say we, I mean Russia, Europe, America, Canada, China, India, Brazil, you name it. The whole world has got to get on board, although the whole world will suffer enormously.
Do we have the technology to sequester emissions?
Not really. There's some very expensive modalities, but we need to make a lot more progress if we're actually going to pull out CO2. We can get CO2 stored in forests and in soils. And that's very, very important. There's a lot we can do there. But going beyond that, we have to actually extract CO2 by mechanical means. And I would say that we've got a ways to go there before that's possible.
Okay, so environmental groups applauded your decision to sign this piece of legislation. They say it's a major step forward. And in general, they applaud your leadership when it comes to reducing carbon emissions. However, they are very critical over your decision and your administration's decision to increase the number of oil and gas wells in the state. They say it's by some 20,000. Yesterday, I spoke with Bill McKibben. He is one of the founders of an environmental group. You probably know who he is, called 350.com. I just want to play a little clip of tape from that interview when he talked about your record on oil wells.
It's just remarkable that he keeps approving permits for wells that are right next to people's houses and schools. That's not normal most places in the world, and it's not fair here where most of them are going in next to communities of color and around poor people. It's really ridiculous at this point for the state that has the technical savvy to be able to move us quickly in another direction.
Okay, so he and environmentalists want an immediate halt to new permits for oil wells. They say it's, you know, causes higher cancer rates, asthma, babies born with birth defects to be near these oil wells. What do you say to that criticism?
Well, I'd say they ought to present that evidence to the local air quality board there in Los Angeles and in the Central Valley and Sacramento and the Bay Area, number one. Number two, they should show up, even though we've invited them in the past, to our Air Resources Board as we formulate our oil and carbon reduction strategies. As a matter of fact, since I've been governor, oil production is down 17%. It's down over 50% from 1985. And we have a very sophisticated, integrated plan to reduce our fossil fuel dependency. If the truth be known, 70% of our oil comes from Saudi Arabia, Texas, Iraq, places like that. So we don't want to just shut in one to open up others that are far more dangerous and threatening to others. So we are doing everything we can to clean up the existing plants, to reduce their need and get to 100% pure renewable electricity, and the same for our cars and trucks and buildings. It's a huge job. We've got a good plan. If they've got some ideas, they ought to present them, not in a demonstration, but in our regulatory hearings, because we are a government of law. It's not just for one person to snap their fingers and say, stop. We have to have a law. We have to have a regulatory process. We need evidence. And we can get there. We will get there. I think the plan we're on now is the best one possible. But I'm sure over the next months and years, people will find ways to improve it and get the job done even faster.
Well, what about the idea that while you are promoting reducing carbon gases, greenhouse gases, by approving permits to drill more oil and for fracking permits, you're actually encouraging the use of fossil fuels?
No, we're reducing it. We're doing just the opposite. We have the strictest rules on oil drilling anywhere in the United States. And yes, we're trying to do our best to get off of it, but just importing more and more from 10,000 miles away doesn't accomplish the goal. You need low-carbon fuels. You need electricity. You need efficient buildings. You need different land use patterns. You need battery storage. You need many things, and we're doing all of that. If there are particular places where, you know, there is clear and present harm or danger, that is well within the authority of local air boards. And if they don't do their job, the state air board will jump in. So we have all the regulatory tools, but we need them to step up, present the evidence, and not just make these claims at the last minute in the manner that they have.
You're talking about the health claims?
Yes. And we have, by the way, I want to also say that we have people, example, in Los Angeles, lives next to freeways. They're not going to move, and we're not going to shut down the freeways or the cars. All we can do is move as quickly as possible to 100% clean vehicles. That's why we have a 5 million electric car goal by 2030, and we want to get there as fast as we can. That is the way to reduce pollution for everyone, and not just shift the burden to Texas or New Mexico or the poor people in Iraq or Saudi Arabia. That doesn't make any sense to me. We got a good plan. If they can make it better, come to our regulatory hearings. They'll be listened to. In fact, we had a workshop on oil production and weighing that against the various other things we're doing. We want to make moves that are cost-effective, that are non- or low-polluting, and that are cost-effective and affordable. That's my plan. If they got some better ideas, hey, I'm open to it.
Well, they want an immediate halt to new permits for oil wells.
Well, good. They should then introduce a bill. You can't just snap your fingers and say, don't drive a car or don't take oil out of your own property. We're not living in some totalitarian country.
Well, you can grant the permit or not.
No, you have to have evidence. If we're going to have a wholesale program that now we're not going to drill. And the logic of that, of course, is stopping all drilling and importing not 70%, but 100%. So I think that bears a lot of scrutiny. It doesn't make a lot of sense at this point.
Okay. I want to turn to another topic, and that is the California Supreme Court. It has been more than a year since you have had a vacancy to fill, and you have not appointed a judge. What's taking so long?
Well, you know, we have plenty of judges there. They serve individuals that kind of try out by going on the court for a few months from the Court of Appeals. You'll get an appointment very soon.
Well, before you leave office, I assume.
Yep. That you can take to the bank.
Okay. But what has taken so long?
What's taken so long? Careful consideration. And I've already filled three vacancies already, and we have just one left, and it'll be taken care of. I've appointed hundreds and hundreds of judges, Courts of Appeal, Superior Court, up and down the state. So we're doing quite a lot on that score, and one of the last that we need to cover now is the Supreme Court itself.
All right. Governor Jerry Brown, thank you for joining us today.
Okay, great. Good to talk with you.
That was California Governor Jerry Brown speaking with us from his office in Sacramento. It's been 10 years since the biggest bankruptcy in history.
It was a manic Monday in the financial markets. The Dow tumbled more than 500 points after two pillars of the street tumbled over the weekend. Lehman Brothers, a 158-year-old firm, filed for bankruptcy.
Lehman Brothers, then the nation's fourth largest investment bank, was allowed to fail, and that touched off the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. In his newest column, New York Times columnist Andrew Ross Sorkin argues that that collapse was the moment that split the country. A split that led eventually to the election of Donald Trump. And Andrew Ross Sorkin joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So this collapse happened on September 15th, 2008. And you say it was actually this collapse, this moment that really split the nation. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, when people look back 10 years ago, they think about an economic collapse. And it was a moment that really cleaved the country. Apart. It created a sense of deep divide and bitterness with finger pointing from all sides. It created new political parties, the Tea Party, the Occupy Wall Street movement, which then pushed the traditional parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, even farther apart from each other. And perhaps even more than all of that, it ended almost a social compact in this country, a sense of trust that people had in governments, in big institutions, in the idea, frankly, of experts, mm-hmm. even, dare I say, in journalism. You talk about the rise of fake news. I could draw a line between all of that and the financial crisis.
Yeah. Well, OK, so here you have a Republican president at the time, George W. Bush, who came up with this plan to save the banks. And then Barack Obama, when he's elected shortly thereafter, carries it out. So two mm-hmm. presidents from two different political parties pretty much agree on bailing out Wall Street and then the automobile sector. So how is it that decision was seen as something that wasn't bipartisan, that wasn't seen as something in the interests of the entire country, but was seen as something that was just carried out in the interests of a few?
So this is the part that to me is so misunderstood about the financial crisis. First of all, historically, after virtually every deep financial crisis in history, there is this uprising of populism. There is this distrust that we talked about. It's the crisis itself that causes that. It's not necessarily the policy response. Yes, there were views on all sides about whether the policy response was to bail out the banks versus the people or too much personal responsibility or too little personal. I mean, all of those issues are real. But what ultimately happened and people seem to miss is the financial crisis and all of the debt that created it was masking much more fundamental and structural problems in our economy, which continue to this very day.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we've had wage stagnation in this country. Nobody appreciated that we had the wage stagnation that we had that was taking place because, frankly, we were all gorging on this debt and life seemed to be just jolly. And this was true also of the workforce, the number of people who were coming out of the workforce. People weren't paying attention to those numbers. People weren't paying attention to the rise of automation and what that was doing to jobs. So, yes, there was an issue about the policy response. But the reason why we've had such a slow recovery, I would argue, is not about the policy response per se to the crisis. It's that we are now living with these much more fundamental issues.
Right, right. Yeah, I love the quote that you have in your piece today from Warren Buffett, where he says something to the effect of, no one knows how many people are swimming naked until the tide goes out. And that really illustrates the point. However, when you look at the, you know, the top line fundamentals, the economy looks really strong, right? Unemployment is at a low 3.9%. GDP is high. Most homes have regained their value and then some since the crash. And yet you're saying that these underlying problems still exist.
They absolutely exist. And you can see it. Yes, the headline numbers are good, but I think we all know people who have felt that this recovery is remarkably uneven. Not everybody has been a beneficiary. I would argue that all boats have been lifted, but not necessarily in an even way. And part of the conundrum that we face in all of this is that inequality has been exacerbated by the crisis, in part because the best or at least most efficient fix for for a crisis is to lower interest rates. And guess what happens when you lower interest rates? Well, people who own assets like homes or stocks, those things go up. They benefit. But if you don't own those things, if you just happen to be a saver even, all of a sudden you're collecting next to nothing in interest. And so you can see that cleave the not only the economy, but the populace even more.
Mm. Right. And then on top of that, the fixes to tighten lending requirements so this wouldn't happen again are keeping some people out of the housing market because they don't have a big nest egg to put down.
This is one of the great ironies of this whole situation. The policy responses that ostensibly work, and when I say ostensibly, because we don't know whether there's another policy that would have worked better, but at least the policies that were enacted, I think history will ultimately actually look at them quite fondly. That's probably a very unpopular thing to say. But the things that are this unpopular happen to have worked, even though it doesn't feel like it worked relative to where people were back then.
But do you think that without this financial crisis, without the shock to the system, Lehman Brothers going bankrupt, et cetera, that there wouldn't have been the same kind of anger and populist anger, that it would have somehow been kept bottled up?
So as long as people could gorge on debt and live in this Alice in Wonderland economy that had been created, I don't think anyone would have been that upset.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that it was an Alice in Wonderland economy, and it was fake. It wasn't real. And when we appreciated that, that's when the recriminations began.
But had there been more of an attempt, as many critics have pointed out on the left and the right, to bail out Main Street rather than Wall Street, that could have done a lot to perhaps assuage the anger.
I do want to point you to what took place in Britain, in the UK, because we had a natural experiment in the world during the crisis. The UK pursued what might be described as all of the popular policies. They fired the executives. They made loans to banks as onerous as humanly possible. They restricted spending. They tried to help homeowners and individuals. And their economy, by the way, did not grow. In fact, their economy grew so slowly relative to ours that I would argue they had an even more populist event than even the election of President Trump, which was Brexit.
Andrew Ross Sorkin, he's the author of the book Too Big to Fail, bestseller, and it's been recently updated. And his documentary Crisis on Wall Street airs tomorrow on CNBC at 7 o'clock Pacific time. Andrew, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Tomorrow, a 12-year-old boy named Eric Castillo is expected to return to Guatemala after months in detention here in the U.S. Eric Castillo was brought across the Arizona-Mexico border by his father. They were caught and they were separated. His father was sent back to Guatemala. Eric was taken to a shelter in Chicago, where he stayed. There are hundreds of children in this situation and a small army of people working to reunite them with their parents here in the United States and in their home countries.
En caso de que alguna persona que fue deportado y que en algún momento su hijo esté todavía allá en Estados Unidos.
That's a radio broadcast from Guatemala asking people to contact a local lawyer if they know anyone separated from their kids in the United States. LA Times immigration reporter Cindy Carcamo tagged along with some lawyers and activists in Guatemala looking for these parents in extremely remote areas.
In some circumstances, you know, there are villages that are inaccessible. Like, they're very difficult to get to, and it would take maybe an entire day.
Because the roads aren't paved.
Because the roads aren't paved, because you have to, like, drive in, and then you have to, like, hike in for hours. And then you also have a security situation. You have areas that are controlled by local gangs or cartels. And so you have to be very cognizant of that. And that's why it's so... these local attorneys are so important because they know this.
Cindy Carcamo says the lawyer she was traveling with found Eric Castillo's family after he got a tip that led him to a small village near the Mexican border After that,
actually was fairly quick. He spoke with the Kokode, which is basically like kind of a community leader, and he knew everyone in town, this guy, and he, like, right away they found the father. But the father was on a taxi run. He drives a taxi. He's trying to make enough money to pay back his smuggler because he still has that huge debt to pay. What ended up happening was he had ended up sending his wife and child to go meet with us to kind of scope it out and find out, like, what we wanted. We later found out.
Because he was suspicious? He thought,
they were distrustful because they had gotten a call like a week before from an American phone number. And the person said, if you send us, I forget how much it was, but it was quite a bit of money. It was like about in the thousands of dollars. Then I will make sure that your child gets back to you. Yes.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. So now there are people trying to profit off this.
I think there are. I mean, I don't know if it's widespread, but she definitely got that phone call. And she's like, do you know anything about this? And I'm like, well, I suspect it's not legitimate, you know, and, you know, the people who are here with me right now who are attorneys, you know, and I explained to her I was a reporter, but that the attorneys, they're doing it free of cost. This is legitimate. What you got was probably not legitimate. And so she was like, oh, good. I'm glad I didn't send him the money. You know, she was supposed to deposit it into a bank in Guatemala. Yeah. So, you know, they're already kind of like distrustful. Also, Guatemala has this history of really horrible botched adoptions. There were allegations of abduction and then putting those kids in the adoption system, and American families adopted these kids. I mean, there was a book written about it by Aaron Siegel McIntyre. And so you definitely have a lot of suspicion, and that's one of the huge obstacles, right? So it's like, and then on top of this, now you have the U.S. government detaining a child and not returning that child. And so it's like, who are these Americans coming and asking for information and making me sign documents? Or not making me, but asking me if I could sign
documents.
And
they have already signed documents.
Yes.
Which sped up their deportation to begin with. And they didn't necessarily understand what they were signing.
Exactly. The father who ended up showing up later, we ended up meeting with him later, like hours later, he said that he was forced to sign documents in English, what he thought was English, because he's illiterate in Spanish and in English. So, he said that he told immigration officials this, and they told them, oh, well, you know, you have to sign anyway. We've spoken with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, tried to get something from them, and they say that they won't comment because of pending litigation.
Okay, so he finally meets with you.
Oh, yes.
And you, or the attorney, is able to convince the family that he's legit and he just wants to reunify
and
him with his son. Mm-hmm. And so...
So basically, they went into a room in this house, and the attorney, Aroldo Palacios, was asking him, like, what happened? Like, how did the separation occur? How long were you separated for? What did the officials tell you?
They have to prove that he is indeed the father of this child who's being held.
Yes.
And so does he come away with enough convincing information?
He does. Aroldo does. And
so then he contacts his person on the U.S. side.
Yes, on the U.S. side. And then what they do is they look into the case and try to see what it is that's gummed up the process of having the child come back.
How old is this child?
This child's 12, Eric.
And the dad wants him back? Want him back?
Yes, they do. Yeah.
And do they know where he is?
Yes, they know that he's in Chicago. They receive like 3 calls a week where they are able to speak with their son. The social worker also calls every once in a while, but they don't have a number that they can call. They have to wait for that phone call.
So we have the identified parents. We know where they are. We know where the child is.
Yes.
So is it just a matter of putting the kid on a plane and having the parents meet the kid at the airport in Guatemala City?
Well, that was the plan. And that was when we left the couple, they were very confident that they were going to get their child back. And actually, the story was going to end with that they were supposed to get their child back on this date. But then that day came and went, and I got a frantic phone call from her.
The mom?
Yes, from the mom. At night, and she's frantic, and she's like, they didn't return my child. We were on our way. She got a call like 2 hours before they got to Guatemala City. I mean, this is an 8-hour trip that they make from their home. And she said the social worker gave me a call, and they told me that they wouldn't return him.
Why?
She said that the judge had changed his mind And I tried to confirm that, but I really had to go with what she said because immigration officials will not talk with me about it.
What a nightmare.
It is for these mothers. Yeah, yeah. For these mothers. I mean, this woman who I spoke with, this mother, she says, and I saw the pants to prove it, that she lost half her weight. And she says that she just doesn't eat. Like, she's just so upset and desperate for her child.
And how many other families are in this situation that you described?
There are nearly 400 families. And most of them are from Guatemala. I mean, just 100 alone are from Huehuetenango, that region that I was in.
Well, Cindy, thank you so much for your reporting. Thanks for telling the story.
Thank you.
Cindy Carcamo covers immigration for the LA Times. If all goes according to plan, Eric Castillo, the boy in her story, will return to Guatemala tomorrow. Coming up, Mean Girls aren't just an American phenomenon. A new play takes place in Africa.
I think it makes for like really ripe conflict, especially when a transfer student shows up and, you know, kind of shakes up everything, especially in our Queen Bee, Paulina's world.
The author of a new play at the Douglas, Schoolgirls, that's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We're going to talk about Mean Girls now.
Oh, my God. I love your bracelet. Where did you get it?
Oh, my mom made it for me. It's adorable. So fetch.
What is fetch?
Oh, it's like slang from England.
So if you're from Africa, why are you white?
Oh, my God, Karen. You can't just ask people why they're white.
Okay, we're not going to talk about Tina Fey's Mean Girls. We're going to talk about Mean Girls who are from Africa, really.
It's not like we just let anyone into our group.
Mm.
So is there a test that you need to pass or something?
Listen, Erica, you're new here, so let me help you understand a few things.
Okay.
I have been running this school for a long time. Nothing and no one crosses me.
Okay, that's Paulina in a play called Schoolgirls, or the African Mean Girls play. It takes place at a boarding school in Ghana. There's the queen bee, Paulina, her gang of loyal followers, and a new girl, Erica, who shakes up the pecking order. Jocelyn Bio is the author of the play, and she joins us now. The play is up at the Kirk Douglas Theater right now. Hi there.
Hi.
Okay, so this is a play from West Africa, from Ghana. Mm-hmm. It takes place in Ghana.
Yeah.
And your parents are from Ghana, correct?
Yes.
And so was their experience an inspiration for this play?
Yeah, the inspiration comes from three different places. One, my mother went to the boarding school that the play is set in. I also went to boarding school, but here in America. It's a very different kind of boarding school,
yeah.
But similar aesthetic.
Similar and similar characters?
Oh,
like,
for sure.
You had Mean Girls in both?
Oh, for sure. For sure. I think that's universal in any school, really. And then I also was super inspired by the 2011 Miss Ghana Universe pageant, where the Ghana pageant officials went and procured a girl who was actually American-born from Minneapolis, who claimed that she was biracial, her mother was white, and that her father was from Ghana. And they brought her back to Ghana to compete in the Miss Ghana pageant, and she won. And it was a scandal, you know, in the, you know, Ghanaian news media, because it was very clear that they thought they would have a more competitive candidate in somebody who was lighter skinned. And I was fascinated by the story, and obviously it didn't make American news, but I just was so interested and perplexed at the idea that American or Western standards of beauty had somehow infiltrated into Ghanaian society. And so I conflated all of these experiences and thoughts into this play, and out came Schoolgirls.
And the general plot outline is that this is about a group of girls in a boarding school who are really excited because they have a chance to compete in this Miss Ghana beauty pageant.
Yes, exactly. From my experience in boarding school, nothing got us more excited when there was like a competition or someone from the outside, you know, was coming to do something with us. And I knew what kind of like fervor that could like create in our community. And so having someone like a pageant recruiter come to a school to look for scouting for the next big thing would have been a very big deal when I was in school. So I put it in the play. And I think it makes for like really ripe, you know, conflict, especially when a transfer student shows up and, you know, kind of shakes up everything, especially in our queen bee, Paulina's world.
Right. So Paulina thinks that she's a shoo-in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And she kind of knows it. I mean, she's just like, you know, she's kind of like an amalgam of all the most like complicated and confident people I've ever met.
Yeah.
And I think Paulina's a lot more than people assume her to be. And I think people find themselves empathizing with her in a way they never thought they would before.
Right. Because in the first act, you just think that she's awful.
Oh, yeah.
She treats her friends, quote unquote, terribly.
Yeah.
She's super mean to them.
She does.
But it's funny, too. Like, there are some cultural missteps. So she talks about how she's got these relatives in America, and America is so, it's like this glittering, you know, fantasy for them. And she says, oh, she works in this incredible place. It's called White Castle.
I mean, every time I go back to Ghana, both my parents are from Ghana, and every time I would go back, there were always these things that would just get lost in translation. And like, you know, and it's like kind of true. I actually remember my cousins asking me, like, you know, in America, is it true? You know, money grows on trees. That's why the leaves are green. And I'm like, the leaves are green here too. Like, you know, it was just like the oddest thing, you know, or that they, you know, they heard that the streets in New York are lined with gold. And, you know, it was the oddest, like, sort of, you know, images of, you know, what America was. But I mean, that just shows how much value is placed in this incredible country, really. It is that you can come here and make your dreams come true, and that these dreams become so inflated and these tall tales of like what America actually is, you know, become, you know, that are folklore really, but become fact, you know, to people. And I always was like very amused by it. So I also just think I'm a comedic writer. I'm a comedic actress. I just, you know, find that comedy is just a funny way of being serious. And so, I always think that it's a great portal for people to like receive a story. Because we do get deep, you know, get deep real quick, you know.
Because when Erica comes, so she is seen as, oh, this emissary from this fantasy land, America.
Yeah.
And she's light skinned.
Mm-hmm.
So she's immediately
different
and seen as better.
Yeah. And I think, you know, in a lot of ways, because the play is set in Africa, in a country, in a continent where everyone really is, you know, darker skinned or black skinned, you have someone like Erica, who's so fair, coming in. And I think she kind of is symbolic of like, you know, a privilege, you know, that in America would be assumed of white people, but in this particular country is assumed of her, you know. And she's like kind of that symbolism for how people move through the world, whether, you know, they acknowledge that privilege or not. And, you know, in Ghana, she would be somebody who's very exotic and different. You know, she's symbolic of some, you know, lineage that they have no, you know, connection or bloodline to. Mm. And I wanted to, you know, like emphasize like how, you know, in America, she would just be a black woman. But in Africa, she would be some, you know, kind of lauded, you know, figure. And she is
because the recruiter sees her, takes one look at her and says, that's my meal ticket.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that's where I think I'm tying it to the inspiration of the play.
So there's the very poignant moment where Paulina has put skin bleaching cream on her for the recruiter to try to, you know, last minute lighten her skin.
Yeah.
And it just really, it's harsh and she starts bleeding on her skin and the whole thing sort of falls apart.
Yeah.
And the two of them, Paulina and Erica, are left together in the room. And that's when we understand Paulina's motivation, that her own mother rejected her because her skin was too dark.
Mm-hmm.
And she says to Erica, my mother would have gladly traded you in for me. The world has decided you're better than me.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, you know, if I'm being honest, it's probably the most vulnerable part of the play for me. It's probably the one that I really is showing all of my cards in a real way, and was the most difficult scene to write. I have gone, as in I'm also an actress, and have really understood what it's like to be in the audition scene and feel inferior to women who were lighter skinned, you know, than me. And I'm a dark skinned woman. And it just took an embarrassingly long amount of time for me to really like own my beauty and really walk confidently in, you know, my skin. I felt for a very long time that I was inferior to, you know, women who were lighter than me. And to be able to so honestly say that, you know, in a play really feels, I don't know, like a full circle in a way. Because I never thought that I feel like that was like a really deep and dark secret. And I would not have shared that with, you know, anyone publicly at all. And so to be able to do that in a play, and in a way that I feel like people of all races, of all cultures can really understand, I hope that they really understand, is really therapeutic for me.
Could you not have done that except through the play?
I don't know. I think I never thought about it. But I, in a way, I feel like it has been such a great portal to share that, because they, people are experiencing the story through this like comedic fun play, and I think I was loath to talk about it because I never wanted to feel this like woe is me deep, you know, conversation. I never wanted anybody to, you know, pity me. So I think possibly that was like the only way I could, and I'm glad I did.
Did you ever try the bleaching cream?
You know, I did, but not in the way that it is portrayed in the play. I did have uneven skin, you know, when I was younger. And this was something that was like used as like an option, but it was never like to the degree and length that a lot of women who, you know, Pauline is kind of symbolizing in the play use the cream for. And in some cases burn all of their skin off, develop complications that, you know, are irreversible. And in extremely, you know, rare cases have, you know, developed some sort of disease or whatever that ended up killing them.
Wow.
And these are super extreme cases, but like when you see, you know, these permanent red burns, you know, on women's faces and body, from trying to lighten their skin and attain a standard of beauty that is like not ours, you know, this is totally a Western, you know, idea. Like, Ghana is a country that sits just above the equator. Like, we're biologically supposed to be darker skinned. but the fact that, you know, this Western standard has like so become, you know, part of Ghanaian culture really saddened me, you know. So, yeah.
What has been the reaction to your play, to that scene?
There's a lot. Overwhelmingly positive reactions to the play. I was actually really overwhelmed with how much people love the play. I really only thought a certain group of people would come and like it and like that's it. I mean, it's a show that invites very vocal reactions. So that is usually the case in almost every show I've ever been to. Certainly last night was like people were really in it, which is really fun.
What do you mean in it?
I mean any insult that's hurled, ooh, zahs, like they're just, you know, they audibly.
I heard when I was there someone in the audience actually talking back to people on stage.
Oh, often. Everything has a reaction in this show, which I love, you know. I know that the play is doing what it needs to do when I can actually verbally hear people feel so moved to even speak to Paulina and tell her to knock it off or whatever the case is. Yeah.
They think she's actually a real person.
Yeah, they do. They do. Maybe they're having flashbacks of high school. I don't know.
Aren't we all? All right. Well, playwright Jocelyn Bio, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That's Jocelyn Bio. Her show is called Schoolgirls or the African Mean Girls Play. It's up now through the end of the month at the Kirk Douglas Theater in Culver City. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Time for a little refresher from HR.
You know, Wendy, you've really been doing a great job.
Thanks, Tom.
It's funny, since you've been here, I feel better about myself. I've not had a lot to feel good about since my divorce.
I don't know what to say. I'm sorry about your divorce.
Well, you sure I can't interest you in some dinner?
Yeah, really, I have to get back. My boyfriend is expecting me.
Oh, I understand. Sure.
Okay, does he really? Cheesy videos and nap-inducing seminars are part of the standard corporate experience. They have been since before the Me Too movement. But in the era of Les Moonves and all the rest, maybe we should give sexual harassment training more of a chance. Ken White is an attorney and co-host of the KCRW podcast, All the President's Lawyers, and he's been giving sexual harassment prevention seminars. He trains supervisors at corporations, churches, police departments, and he's here now. Hi, Ken.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. Okay, so is your seminar kind of like that one, or is it a little more interesting?
I try not to make it like that one, and I actually avoid the cheesy videos that used to be in favor because in my experience, people generally cringe or laugh at them and don't react to them. So my theory is that you can't just be talking at the people. You have to engage them somewhat, get them invested in the topic, and get them interested in, you know, what the law actually is.
Yeah. So what is a good way? You said engaging one-on-one or engaging with real people is a good way. And what in that engagement really gets people to say, oh, okay, I get this now?
Part of it is taking their questions and their concerns seriously and answering them directly and respectfully, truthfully, not like sort of encoded lawyer language. Part of it is acknowledging the bad messages that they get from the culture. You know, a lot of people hear the steady drumbeat of complaints that, oh, anyone can sue anyone for anything, and sexual harassment, it's easy for anyone to make up a complaint, and usually the complaint is it's easy for women to do that. And why even try if anything you do can be sexual harassment? Most of that is just nonsense. Sexual harassment law is not as powerful as people think, and it's not as easy to make a successful case as people think. And what I do is I go through cases, real cases, so they can see, okay, what kind of behavior actually gets people into real trouble and what kind of behavior doesn't? What sort of things result in liability and what don't? And by the end of it, a lot of the time, people who started out thinking, oh, you know, you can sue for anything, you can get money for no reason at all, by the end of the training, a lot of the time those people are saying, wow, I'm actually kind of surprised that person got away with that. I would never do that. And they have more of an appreciation that, no, these are rational rules. They're about having respect for other people in the workplace and, you know, acting right. And I can understand and follow these rules.
I think a lot of people feel like sexual harassment training is just there to protect the company from lawsuits.
That's certainly one component. So normally, you know, if you're a supervisor at a company, like our friend in that audio, if you sexually harass someone, the company's on the hook for it automatically. But when there's sexual harassment by non-supervisors, by other line employees, then the company's not on the hook unless they knew or should have known of the harassment and didn't take reasonable steps to stop it. So training is part of that reasonable step that helps protect the company. But there's also a genuine component where it can, if it's done right, help companies train people to behave right.
Okay, and you have this thing called the 85-10-5 rule. What is that?
Well, what I tell people is that 85% of you that I'm talking to are never going to harass anybody. You're just not going to act that way at work. It's not in your nature. And you just have to sit through this. Sorry. 10% of you might cross a line, but you can be trained not to. You're acting here in good faith. You want to know how to act right, and you'll listen to what I have to say. And then 5% of you are untrainable. You're going to do what you're going to do, you know, whether it's, you know, skydiving without a helmet or harassing the person at work, whatever it is, you're going to do whatever you feel like doing. And in your case, we're just trying to make a record that we did our best to train you.
Oh, okay. So that's where the lawsuit prevention or the inoculation from lawsuits comes in. For that 5%.
Yes, and generally at that moment in the training, everyone is looking at each other, thinking who the 5% in their workplace really is.
How did you come up with that 5% number?
Yeah, I'll tell you the truth. I've been doing this for so long now, like 13 years. I don't even remember exactly, but I think there were some studies about, you know, what percentage of any particular group tends to be the troublemakers. And it's certainly been my experience in the trainings, just from the spot sample, the sort of questions you get, and my experience in litigating sexual harassment cases, both for plaintiffs suing companies and defending companies, that it's just that small percentage that caused the vast amount of the problem.
Okay. What is the most outrageous question you've been asked at one of these trainings?
I got asked whether it would be okay to have a team building event at a nudist colony. And let me just add that this was after I went on my rant, and you can only describe it as a rant about stop doing team building exercises at strip clubs and at Hooters and at places like that. It's just not smart. So, you know, I have to admire that the person felt comfortable to ask me the question. So even if I think I was stunned into silence for about a minute.
It wasn't a joke question. It was actually a sincere question.
I believe it was a sincere question. But, you know, this stuff is mysterious. I practice it all day, so it seems obvious to me. But a lot of people out there, they just hear all these ridiculous stories in the media. They hear all these distortions of what the law really is. Those distortions are often political in nature, designed to, you know, discredit one side of the political spectrum or the other, or discredit the idea of sexual harassment law. So they get a lot of distorted messages. And a lot of times, you know, it's not that people are happy about listening to me talk for 2 hours, but I feel like I've done my job if at the end of it, people are less anxious. If they go, okay, I kind of understand what this is. It's not what I was scared it was, and I can do this. I can deal with this.
Ken White, he's an attorney, co-host of the KCRW podcast, All the President's Lawyers. You can read more about his sexual harassment training in The Atlantic. Ken, thank you so much.
Thank you.